This is the last talk we've got in a series we've been doing on communication. A few weeks ago, Bodhilila launched the series, and she talked about some of the Buddha's advice on communication. She particularly showed us that sort of grid of how he's suggesting you should combine things like truthful and kindly communication and the importance of finding the right time and so on. And then we had a look at particularly truthful communication, then at kindly communication. Then we had a special guest, Jai Raja, who came down to talk about helpful communication, somebody who's got a lot of experience of communication skills. And then last week, Vlasmani on harmonious communication. So we've been through what are called the four speech precepts. So when we were reciting the precepts before the meditation, there were five precepts there. And one of them was to do with speech. You remember, with truthful communication, I purify my speech. But actually, there's a longer list of precepts that's taken on by ordained members of our own order, which is known as the Ten Precepts, which goes back to the time of the Buddha. And in that, instead of one precept, there are four precepts. We've got not just truthful speech, but also kind or loving speech, helpful or useful speech, and harmonious speech. And those have been the themes of the last few weeks. So we've done all those. So today, originally I was thinking maybe it could be a little bit of a one of those things. Do you ever read in The Guardian, "This column can change your life," where it sort of describes lots of little tips as to how you can have a more constructive approach to life? So I thought maybe we could do that. And then I thought, no, it's Christmas. You know, it's time for celebrations. I'd rather just do a bit of tell you some stories, really. So I hope you don't mind not getting all those tips. Maybe there will be some tips, though, in the stories. And I wanted to go back again, as Bodhilila did, to the Buddha himself and the time of the Buddha. So as you probably know, we're talking about 400 or 500 years BCE in northeastern India, where Buddhism started, started by the Buddha. But before I do that, I want to go back a little less far. I want to go back some 40 years to the origins, not of Buddhism as a whole, but the origins of here, the West London Buddhist Centre. The charity that runs the centre was founded in 1976, but there were activities even before then, and they were run by a man called Van Giesa. And I wanted to talk about Van Giesa because his namesake is the main hero of one of the stories I want to tell about the time of the Buddha. And I thought you might just be interested to hear a little bit about the origins of the West London Centre, in case you haven't done so before. So so Buddhism in England was, in the 1960s, was a little bit rudimentary. And towards the end of the 60s, what is now called the Triratna Buddhist Community was started. And a number of ordinations happened in 1968. And one of those people ordained in 1968 was a man called Van Giesa. Now, Van Giesa was an Irishman, he was an actor, and the reason he was given the name Van Giesa was because Van Giesa was this great early Buddhist poet. In fact, probably the first great poet in the history of Buddhism. He's a contemporary of the Buddha, Van Giesa. And Van Giesa, the modern Van Giesa, the Irish actor, had this wonderful speaking voice, was himself a poet, and loved to recite poetry. And I remember I was very fortunate in that I met him, and I can remember him being around and being quite impressed by him, a big man with a lovely smile and this really wonderful, resounding voice. The only photograph I could find was this rather poor one here, but I'll pass that round so you can get a sense of him. He's the one on the left. The right, sorry, the one with a moustache. Yes, he's got. He actually, I do remember his moustache. He had this really lovely late 60s style moustache, one of the ones that goes down like this, sort of a head of hair. He had two children and a wife, very stable family background, very loving family background. And I thought I was just starting to come along to the London Buddhist Centre over in Bethnal Green, and I met him and said, "I really want to get to know this guy." And I was very fortunate. I had a chance to have a cup of tea with him in the little restaurant that's attached to the Buddhist Centre in East London. So I can remember us sitting down at the table. I don't remember what we talked about, but I remember how delightful it was. And the reason I was so pleased about it is because only a few weeks later, He had a heart attack and died, tragically. And he was only, 51, 52? He wasn't an old man by any means. And this had a huge effect, the death of Bhagisa. Now, before then, in the late 70s, because he lived in Ealing, he started running some classes in Ealing. He started them, I believe, he started them in the Friends Meeting House, which is where we still have classes now in Ealing. And he started teaching meditation, introducing people to Buddhism. And a few years later, that became more formalised. A charity was set up. And ever since then, it's been the West London Buddhist Centre, which has been a little bit nomadic. It's moved from centre to centre. You know, it's after a mere 20 years or so, it decides that the old centre's too small. Mm-hmm. And it decides it wants something bigger, which is what happened 3 years ago when we moved here. But that was all started by Bhagisa, a very wonderful, charismatic man. And I had that meeting with him. A few weeks later, I heard he died. This was in early 1981. And so this was the first time I'd ever been to a Buddhist funeral. And it was quite an eye-opener, the funeral of Bhagisa. What really surprised me was what a joyful occasion it was. So the first thing was that, if you imagine, in the meditation room, the shrine room at the London Buddhist Centre in Bethnal Green, his coffin was right in the middle like that, and it was open. So everyone would come in and look at him and, you know, make their farewells and then sit and meditate. So people who, it was in there all day, maybe even 2 days, so many, many people would come and meditate with him and just sit with him and say their farewells. And then there was a funeral, and the coffin was put into a mauve-coloured Volvo estate rather than one of these big black hearses. And it drove slowly along with a procession behind it. And everyone was encouraged to wear their brightest clothes. And everyone was carrying a single tulip. It was the spring, as I say. And I can remember us wending our way through the cemetery up to the crematorium, just following with these flowers. It was very, very moving. And then back at the centre, there was a special puja and so on. And I can remember his wife and both his children, and his boy was only 11 at the time. You know, really tragic for him to lose his father at such a young age. And he played the flute. Again, it's very vivid still in my mind, even though it's 1981, just watching the young boy playing the flute in memory of his father. He was very nervous to get up there, but very pleased to have done so. And it did make such a difference to the family, apparently. They weren't particularly Buddhists, but just to have their father celebrated and the husband celebrated so positively, with so many positive memories. I've never heard a single ill word of Bhagisa. Everybody thought he was a wonderful man, so it was really tragic he died so young. And he was named after this great poet, deliberately named after that. That was a bit of the fashion in those days. There weren't so many order members around, so you could be quite selective in what name you chose if you were the preceptor for the order members. So, for example, another man I met around that time was called Chanda. And Chanda was the name of the Buddha's charioteer. And this was because he was a London taxi driver. There was another guy at the time who was very keen on William Blake. And so instead of being given a Buddhist Sanskrit name, he was given a name from Blake's mythology, Luva, the Zoa of love, Luva. And there were a few other examples like that. Anyway, I'm going to go back to Bhagisa. I'm going to go back not to the Irish actor Bhagisa, but I'm going to go back to the original Bhagisa. But first of all, I want to start with another character from the time of the Buddha, whose teachings and who what was taught to him is very relevant to understanding communication, particularly the first of those four speech precepts, the precept of truthful communication and avoiding, in other words, avoiding false speech, avoiding misleading, avoiding lying. And this is what the precept says. This is the translation of the Pali that we were reciting. And it says, I take upon myself the footstep of learning to avoid misleading communication. To avoid misleading communication. Musa vada. Vada means communication or speech. Musa means false or misleading. And the story I wanted to tell here was about a seven-year-old boy. And this seven-year-old boy was being taught by the Buddha. The Buddha would actually teach children. And when he taught children, he would do so in a very simple way. However, this particular seven-year-old boy, I don't know if anyone can guess who he was the Buddha's son. The Buddha's son. So we need to go back, he's 7 years old, to his birth, or even a little bit before his birth, because this is the time when the Buddha was still living at home with his wife and his father and his foster mother and all his relatives in this small kingdom of Kapilavastu, the city of Kapilavastu, the kingdom of the Shakyas, on the border of the Himalayas. And already at this stage, the Buddha, or Siddhartha Gautama as he was then, he'd had the four sights. In other words, the issue for him of human suffering, human aging, illness, death, as being a real problem for people, it had already hit him and he didn't know the answer. And he couldn't work out what to do about it. And he already had the sense that he had to go and seek for that answer. But he was in a family situation. He was very much in love with his wife. And then his wife became pregnant. And she gave birth to a son. And he had this overwhelming emotional response to the little baby. And he talked to Yashodhara, his wife. And they were saying, what should we call the little boy? What should we call the little boy? And he had this... this is very shocking to some people, I know. But he had this mixed response. He had this enormous, overwhelming sense of love towards the boy, towards the baby. But also the sense that this is an impediment to me leaving home and seeking the truth. And he said to Yashodhara, I know what we should call him. We're going to call him Bond. Bond, he said. We're going to call him Bond because he felt he was a bond that was holding him in the family situation. So this poor little boy had to grow up with the name Bond. Yeah, and actually, I don't know. Well, maybe it's not such a bad name, perhaps. Yeah. Bond, my name is Bond. Siddhartha Bond. Anyway, and the original is Rahula. I should say that some people disagree with this, by the way. I've been looking in the scholarship on it, and some people say Rahu was the name of the eclipse of the moon. It's called Rahu. And some people say, oh no, it's just he was born on the time of the eclipse of the moon, so he's called Rahu after the eclipse. But Rahula usually means a bond. And so what happens is, when the boy, well, some people even say the very same day the baby is born, the Buddha says, if I stay here any longer, there'll be a little girl, then another little boy, and all my responsibilities will grow bigger and bigger. If I'm ever going to go and seek the truth, it's got to be now, in the middle of the night. So he goes into his wife's room, and his wife, of course, is holding the baby. And according to some of the stories, it says he really wanted to look, before he left, he wanted to look, gaze on the face of his son. But his wife's arm was over the little boy's face, and he couldn't see the boy's face. And he was almost going to go forward, and then he thought, if she wakes up, I'll never be able to leave. I just couldn't do it, you know. Because he was very attached to her. And so he quietly steals out of the room and off he goes. And of course, that is another story. So I'm not going to go into what happens then. If you don't know, do read it up. It's fascinating what happens over the following 7 years. 7 years later, the Buddha has been enlightened for 1 year. So he's been through all this searching. In a way, from his, at least to his satisfaction, he's found the answer to the problems of old age, and suffering, and sickness, and death. And the answer being the enlightenment, the deathless, as he called it. And he started teaching. And he decides to go back. It's time for him to go back. It's time for him to go back to his father, to his wife, to his son, to his home. And so off he goes. And when he gets there... see what he says. He returns to Kapilavastu, and it says Yashodhara, his wife, took the little Rahula, who's 7 years old, to listen to the Buddha teaching. And when they arrived, she said to the seven-year-old boy, Rahula, that is your father. That is your father. Because, of course, he's never seen his father since he was a tiny baby. That is your father. And Rahula says to his father, he says, and this is one of those mysterious things you find in the Buddhist scriptures. He says, "Sir, your shadow is sweet. Your shadow is sweet." And then Yashodhara says to the little boy, she says, "Rahula, go and ask for your inheritance." Because the Buddha was the heir to, at least it's often said, the heir to the throne, or at least to the republican presidency of the place where they grow up. And, of course, he's still alive, but he's clearly not going to do the job. He's bumped off the job. He's just wandering around, sort of enjoying himself as an enlightened being. And he's bumped off his responsibilities of being the ruler of this country. And, of course, you know, we don't know how long his father's going to live. So his wife says to the little boy, "Ask for your inheritance. Make sure that your father confirms that you are the heir and that you can have it now. You don't have to sort of wait." And so the little boy, imagine the little seven-year-old boy going up to the Buddha, and he says, "Sir, can I please have my inheritance?" And so the Buddha says, "Your inheritance is the Dharma. Go and talk to Ananda, and he'll teach you the Dharma." And so the little boy goes and gets to know Ananda, who's one of the Buddha's disciples, who's very well known as a really excellent teacher. And the boy became a sort of a monklet, if that's the right word. And much to the grandfather's disgust. And the grandfather actually went and complained to the Buddha. He says, "Look, not only is your son left to become a little monk, a number of your other relatives have as well. You know, we're getting depleted." And they didn't ask their parents' permission. And so the Buddha said, "Okay, well, fair enough. I do understand your point of view." And he says, "From now on, anyone who wants to become a monk or a nun, at least up to a certain age, needs to make sure they've asked the permission of their parents or their wife or husband," which is interesting, isn't it? Maybe permission is the wrong word, but at least talk it over with them and make sure that they understand the point of view and that they're happier with it. So that became a rule, but the rule was broken in the case of Rahula. He just went off. And so you've got this little seven-year-old boy, and he turns up quite often, this little boy. And sometimes it's Ananda talking to him and teaching him, but sometimes it's the Buddha. And that's why I've got these things here, because the way the Buddha taught Rahula, I think, is very interesting, because it is, like, it's very, very simple. It's very simple what he says. And he wants to talk to the boy about lying. Now, it doesn't actually say this, but, you know, seven-year-old kids do have a tendency sometimes to lie. You know, they want to get their own way. And so I sort of assume that that's what's happened. The little boy has told some sort of a lie. And his father is talking to him, a bit like George Washington talking to his father, you know, about who chopped down the cherry tree, that old story. Anyway, forget about that one. But you've got Rahula talking to the Buddha. And the Buddha says, he says, "Do you see this jar of water?" And Rahula says, "Yes." And the Buddha says, "There's not much water in it, is there?" He says, "No." And he says, "It's the same with people who lie." He says, "There's not very much virtue in them. There's not very much balance." It's an unusual word he uses. There's very little balance in those who have no shame in intentional lying. If you don't feel remorse if you do that, it shows that there isn't very much balance. There isn't very much virtue in you. And then he says, he poured it away. He poured it on the ground, but I'm not going to do that here. So he pours the water onto the ground, and he says, "Do you see that water on the ground that I've just thrown away?" And he says, "Even so, Rahula, thrown away is the balance of those who have no shame in intentional lying. You've thrown it away. You've just thrown it away because you have no shame in intentional lying." And then you see, I better not do this, I might break this, but he knocks over the water pot like this, and he says, Do you see this pot that I just knocked over? Yes, sir. It says, even so unbalanced are those who have no shame in intentional lying. And then he picks up the pot again and he says, do you see this pot? Completely empty, nothing in it. This just empty pot. And that Rahala says, yes. He says, even so, Rahala, empty and void is the harmony and balance of those who have no shame at intentional lying. And so he really pushes this. He impresses upon Rahula the importance of speaking the truth. And it does occur to me, this one. It's like, I don't know how much this came up in our talks, because I think we are very sophisticated and we tend to have also, but sometimes you should lie. And I'm sure there may be some truth in that. A very extreme example is the Gestapo is coming to pick up Anne Frank. Is she in the attic or not? You say, I have no Anne Frank in my attic. Fair enough, you lie, yeah. But sometimes I think we give ourselves justifications. I won't tell my mum about such and such because it'll upset her. And I won't tell this person the truth about their health because they can't take it. Then we give ourselves little excuses for not being truthful, rather than maybe for finding ways of being truthful, finding the right time to do it, making sure we can tell the truth with a kindly intention and so on. So I don't know, it's worth reflecting on that, I think, because probably all of us have got our little reasons as to why we sometimes exaggerate or sometimes, you know, hide things from people and so on. And the Buddha, to Rahula at least, is saying, look, don't do that. And in fact, later he says, don't even do it in jest. He says, Rahula, for anyone who has no shame in intentional lying, there is no evil that person cannot do. Therefore, you should train yourself like this. I will not tell a lie, not even in jest. And the example that Buddha gives is he says, imagine an elephant that's being trained up for battle. If the elephant is trained up, because they used elephants in warfare in India in those days, and probably you know Alexander the Great, when he invaded India, he had to face these elephants, you know. He says, an elephant that's being trained up for battle has no compunction about trampling people to death. Is the same for a person who deliberately lies. They have no compunction about other unskillful behaviour. And I don't know, you know, one could look into that. Why should that be? Is that true or not? But I think the suggestion is that if you lie, you lie to yourself. You mislead yourself. And as a result, you don't really have a touchstone for saying, you know, what is my integrity? Do I have integrity or not? I don't even really know what the truth is. I can't quite remember what I've said to people. And so that means that you can, in a way, fool yourself. You can do things that are really harmful to other people, but you lie to yourself about, oh no, I did it for good reasons and all that kind of thing. So in a way, he's almost saying that the first of the precepts to keep is the truthfulness precept. And I'm sure we can have a big debate about this. And I'm sure you can think of, oh, what about such and such? What about such and such? But just worth thinking about it. Not as a dogma, not as something rigid. But yeah, that's interesting. Is that true? How important is it to have integrity, to really be able to speak the truth, to speak what's genuinely on my mind, in a way that is kind and timely, of course. That's right. When he'd explained all this to his son, and when he's told him what has to be done, he doesn't stop there, the Buddha. He says, how do you do this? How can you be truthful? And he says, he picks up a mirror. So this is actually a tray, but probably it's a bit similar to what you had in 500 BC. It wouldn't be a wonderful mirror like we have now. So he shows Rahula the mirror. He says, look at this mirror. So little boy, 7-year-old boy, he's looking in the mirror at himself, yeah, sort of touching his nose and all that kind of thing. And he says, what's this for? What is this for? And Rahula says, well, the purpose of a mirror is so you can look at yourself. Yeah? Remember, you know, little boy, very simple teaching. And the Buddha says, even so, Rahula, one should act and speak or even think only after you've first looked at yourself. Look at yourself as if you've got a mirror. He says, before acting or speaking, one should think, what I'm about to do, will it harm me? Will it harm others? Use the mirror, look at yourself, and try and make that decision. If you can answer, yeah, it will, it'll harm me, or it'll harm others, then you should not act or speak. But if you can answer, no, that won't harm me, that won't harm others, then you should act or speak. You should reflect with the mirror reflection in the same way while you're acting, not just before you act, but while you're acting, in the middle of your acting, look at yourself. And after you've acted, look at yourself. Did it harm me? Did it harm others? So it's a very simple teaching, which he developed later into what's called the mirror of mindfulness. So this is mindfulness in the sense of self-reflection. Before you act, look at yourself. While you're acting, while you're speaking, look at yourself. After you act or speak, look at yourself. So I think that's quite interesting. We will act or speak. You should train yourself thinking, we will act or speak only after repeatedly looking at ourselves, only after reflecting on ourselves. And we use that word ourselves, don't we? Reflection. Look at this. Okay, so that's a little bit. I thought that was quite interesting, just to look at those very, very simple, but in a way quite strong teachings that the Buddha gave to the little seven-year-old boy about lying and even about mindfulness. Just look at yourself. Decide. And I think that's a very, very good thing for a child to learn. It's very good for us to learn as well, the importance of reflection, the importance of not just being hasty, not just thinking the first thing that comes to mind, the first thing that comes into my mouth, I'll just say it, whatever. And he's saying, no, just a little pause. A little pause. Just look in the mirror. Look at yourself. Now, the next precept, we've had the one on truthful speech. The next precept is on harsh and loving speech. Avoiding harsh speech, practicing loving speech. And the translation of the Pali of the negative version says, I take upon myself the footstep of training to avoid words designed to hurt. To avoid words designed to hurt. And so this is where I wanted to talk a little bit about the original Vanghisa. Now, he's a bit mysterious, the original Vanghisa. A lot of his poems were preserved in the Pali Canon. At least 15 poems in the Pali Canon and a few others scattered about in other sources as well. Which is quite amazing, you know, for those poems to survive for 2,500 years, it seems to me. And he was obviously very well known as a poet after he'd become a Buddhist. And he was clearly, he saw himself as a poet before he was a Buddhist as well. But his job, apparently, was rather different. And this is something I'm a bit suspicious about this. It might be there were two people called Vanghisa and they got confused. Because the commentary says, before Vanghisa became a Buddhist, he was a specialist in tapping skulls, which is why I've got this skull here. That was his profession. He was a Brahmin, and the Brahmins, of course, they took up most of the religious jobs. And what he would do was, he would make his living by going from village to village, and he would say to people, would you like to know whether your relatives, whether your mum, who's dead, went to heaven or not? And they'd say, oh, yeah, really, well, I'd like to know. Did she go to heaven? Yeah. Yeah, or what? Oh, where is she now? He said, okay, all I need is the skull. So they had to go out with a spade, dig up mum's skull, and bring it to Vanghisa. And Vanghisa would get his little hammer, and he'd go... And after he'd given it a few taps, he'd say mantras while he did this, these sacred mantras, he'd be going... Om, skull, skull scrying, swaha, and so on. These mystic mantras of the skull, probably a load of crap actually, but anyway, this is what he was doing, you know. And then he'd say, your mother, I can see her now. She is in heaven amongst the devas, having a lovely time, you know. Or sometimes, you know, he'd say, oh, your poor mother has been reborn as a mongoose and she lives in the compost heap. Or that kind of thing. And he became very popular. And this is the way he made his living. And he went around with an entourage from village to village doing this. And so he arrives at Travesti, where the Buddha is living. And the Buddhists there hear about this guy. And they are a bit suspicious of him. And so they think they're going to put him to the test. So they bring along 5 human skulls and they put them in front of Vanghisa in a row and they say, we've got a challenge. Can you tell where these have gone? Now, the Buddhists, at least some of them, they also believe they could tell where people got reborn. So therefore, they feel they could actually do a proper test. So, you know, this person was reborn as a mongoose in the compost heap. This one was reborn in heaven. This one was sort of reborn, you know, as the next door neighbour or something. So five skulls. So you go through the skulls, you know, first skull, second skull, and he says, oh yeah, this person has been reborn in the family of a merchant in the town of such and such, you know. And all the Buddhist monks go, ooh, he's right, he's right. And skull number two, you know. So he goes through the skulls and he gets them all right. He gets to skull number five. And he says, I can't tell. That is the first skull I've ever come across where I don't know where this person has ended up. And the Buddhist monks say, ah, that's because he was enlightened. And you cannot tell where the enlightened go after they die. And Vangisa is very impressed by this. He says, what mantra, what special magic spell can I learn to tell whether one of my clients is enlightened or not? I realise there is a gap in my art. I need to know this. And so they say, you're going to have to join the Buddhist order if you're going to do that. We'll teach you special mantras for it. So it seems a bit of a cheat, really, isn't it? Anyway, but that's what they say. And he says, oh, yes, I'm going to do that. So he decides to become a monk and he joins the Buddhist order. So this is the story about, and it doesn't mention his poetry, but it's quite clear. He never mentions this fact in his poems, that he used to be a skull tapper. All he mentions is that he was always a poet, and he talks quite a lot about that. So it's a nice story, but I sort of rather doubt it myself as whether it really was Vangisa. But maybe you can see more deeply into it. You can see some symbolic connection between this process of skull tapping and understanding the destiny of people and the art of poetry. I don't know. Do let me know if you can. So he becomes, he becomes a Buddhist monk. He becomes a follower of the Buddha, and actually he gets really into it. If he ever was a skull tapper, he forgets all about his skull tapping. He's not interested anymore about learning the special mantra, and he starts, practicing as best he can. And some of his poems are about his early practice. Oh yes, that's interesting, yes. That's right, somebody turns up, according to the story, and asks Vangisa, did you learn it? Did you get the mantra? And Vangisa said, you'd all better go now, but as for me, I'm not going back with you. This was his Brahmin companions. He says, I'm going to do meditating anyway. And he says, Vangisa... the Buddha says, Vangisa really now knows the death and rebirth of beings because he's gained enlightenment. So eventually he did manage to gain enlightenment. After one of the poems he recites, the Buddha asks Vangisa, he says, look, that was a brilliant poem. Did you just make that up on the spot? Or did you spend weeks composing it? And Vangisa says, no, it just comes to me. And the Buddha says, let's have some more then. Will it come to you? And he recites another poem. And it just sort of comes to him. And every time he says a poem, he'll go up to, sometimes he's with the Buddha, sometimes with someone else, and he'll say to them, it's rising up. It's rising up. It's coming to me. It's coming to me. And they say to him, Vangisa, let it come. Let it rise up. And then out comes this poem. You know, out comes this beautiful poem. So on one occasion, the Buddha was giving a talk, and this is in a way my excuse for talking about Vangisa here. I mean, obviously poetry is to do with communication, but it's a bit more than that, because the Buddha gave a talk on good communication, and he emphasised four qualities in particular in this talk. He says your speech should be skillful, it should be useful, it should be pleasing, and it should be truthful. And Vangisa was listening to this talk, And he gets up and he says, "It's coming. It's rising up. It's coming to me. It's coming to me." And the Buddha says to it, "Let it come. Let it come." And Vangisa recites his poem. And this is the poem. "Let us use words that do not cause us pain. Let us use words that do not hurt each other. Those truly are wholesome words. Let us use pleasant speech where the words make people glad. Not laying hold of others' faults. Let us use pleasant speech on others. The words of truth are like the nectar of immortality, the deathless. And this fact is timeless. As the old saying goes, words of truth cannot die. The best people, they say, are well grounded in all these forms of perfect speech, in truth, in welfare, and in virtue. But the words that the Buddha speaks excel all others. They are the words that lead to nirvana. They put an end to suffering." So this is the little poem that he composes. And, of course, the trouble is in translation, it's very difficult with poetry in translation, isn't it? Unless the translator is a poet. I was just wondering if I could try saying what it is in Pali. Are there any Pali scholars here who speak Pali well? Because I was going to ask you to recite it if you do. It's a little bit of a relief, actually. So you won't know how bad my Pali pronunciation is. So this is what it sounds like. I'll just give you the first little verse. Tang eva vachang bhaseya ya attanam natapeya parecha na vihimseya save vacha subhasita. And I don't know if you can get it. The Pali is very metrical language. So a lot of the poetry is often in the rhythm of the words. But it also, like English, it uses rhyme sometimes as well. So you'll have the last syllable rhyming. And you'll have sometimes a very strict meter, sometimes a much more loose meter. It's very, very variable, Pali, in that way. Yes, I don't know if that gives you a sense of what it might sound like. And of course, we don't even know if that's what it would have sounded like in those days. But at least that's the Pali as preserved for today. So the next precept, that's the second of the speech precepts, was loving speech. The next one is on useless speech, trying to avoid that, and helpful speech, which is one of the things that Vangisa mentions, of course, in that poem. And so here the precept, translated, says, "I take upon myself the footstep of learning to avoid empty words, to avoid empty words." Now, Vangisa had always been a very fine poet, even before he became a Buddhist. And I suspect that his verses helped him in his practice, in his meditation practice, in his progress towards enlightenment. And I think this is one of the things about expressing yourself, learning to express yourself in poetry. It's not just something which is nice for others. It gives you a sort of an eloquence that allows you to explain your own experience to yourself. Poetry can convey the truth of Buddhism in some ways more effectively than lists or concepts or philosophical arguments. Poetry means using images, using metaphors, and putting these together in harmonious and pleasing ways. And apparently, Vangisa's verses, Pali verses, were very beautiful. But he wrote a poem for himself, or a number of poems actually for himself, it seems, to try to describe what was happening. And there's a whole book of poems by the early Buddhist monks, which is this one here in translation called the Terragata. The Terragata means the verses of the elders. And the last and longest section is Vangisa's poetry. As I say, it includes some 15 poems all run together. And in a way, Vangisa has the pride of place here. But it's worth having a look at, if you're interested, to have a look at some of these poems. There's another volume by the early Buddhist bhikkhunis, the nuns as well, which is sometimes said to be the first known religious writing by women in the whole world. And they're both the monks and the nuns verses are really, really striking. Some of them, very beautiful descriptions of experience, of tragedy, of crises in life, but also descriptions of nature, descriptions of meditation experience, descriptions of what it's like to get enlightened, descriptions of their devotion to their own teachers or to the Buddha. So they're fantastic, these poems. And maybe Van Gieser's are the best. Yes, they are the longest anyway, certainly. So this is my very free translation of the poem he wrote in a way for himself, or one of the poems he wrote for himself, to help him with his practice. Here am I. I've left the household life to follow the Buddha. Yet, obsessive thoughts of all the girls I've known assail my mind. So this was, it wasn't the only hindrance he had, actually. He mentions other ones in other poems. This particular one was remembering his old girlfriends. And then he says, this is where metaphor comes in. The god of love with his flowery arrows is like 1,000 fine archers surrounding me. So as he's sitting there in meditation, he feels like there are 1,000 archers with their flowery arrows of desire pointing at him. And then he says, yet I will not tremble, for I have heard from the Buddha, bright as the sun, the way that leads to supreme peace of mind. My mind latched on to that way that the Buddha taught. O god of love and death, though you assail me, you will never find the path I take. I'm entirely giving up both liking and disliking. I'm entirely giving up both liking and disliking, not clinging to anything at all. Whatever I find in the earth and the sky, plunging into the world, all that is impermanent. All that is decaying. The wise never forget this. People are bound to their acquisitions. I drive away that clinging. People are caught up in a tangled net of many opinions. I shall not grasp at views. Much less will I grasp at what is unskillful. Here, the fires of longing are quenched. Here is the peaceful state, and here I bide my time. Shall I read that one again? It's difficult to take in the first time, sometimes, isn't it? So, here am I. I've left the household life to follow the Buddha, yet obsessive thoughts of the girls I've known assail my mind. The god of love with his flowery arrows is like 1,000 fine archers surrounding me, yet I will not tremble. Yet, for I have learnt from the Buddha, bright as the sun, the way that leads to supreme peace of mind. My mind latched on to that way. O god of love and death, though you assail me, you will never find the path I take. I'm entirely giving up both liking and disliking, not clinging to anything at all. Whatever I find in the earth and the sky, plunging into the world. At that, all that is impermanent and decaying. The wise never forget this. People are bound to their acquisitions. I drive away that clinging. People are caught up in the tangled net of many opinions. I shall not grasp at those views, much less will I grasp at what is unskillful. Here the fires of longing are quenched. Here is the peaceful state. Here I bide my time. So there's his... It's quite rousing. It's quite, I mean, do you see, in a way, the difference between a list, a teaching? You know, the Buddha, in the teaching that Van Gieser was responding to, was saying, yeah, in your speech you need these factors to be present. It needs to be truthful. It needs to be useful. It needs to be... But here's Van Gieser. He's put that into imagery. He's put it into rousing self-encouragement. As well. So I put that under the precept of helpful speech. And helpful speech can be speech to yourself that helps you, the way you understand your own meditation or your own practice or your own life. And then the final one of the speech precepts is to do with negatively slanderous speech and positively harmonious speech. That's the last one. And here is what it says, translated from Pali. I take upon myself the footstep of learning to avoid driving people apart. In other words, Slanderous speech means divisive speech that's designed to divide people from each other. And we heard about that last week from Vlasamani. And his harmonious speech, Vangisa's harmonious speech, comes in his skill, his enthusiasm, in particular in appreciating others. There are more poems of appreciation from Vangisa than any other topic, where he looks at people he knows, usually the great disciples of the Buddha or the Buddha himself, and he just says, what a brilliant guy. But rather than just saying that, he puts it in much more detailed and specific terms. A good half of his poems are about his comrades, other disciples of the Buddha. So this is the one on Shariputra, or Sariputta, who you've probably heard about. And Sariputta, who was probably the most important disciple of the Buddha, who's regarded as the originator of the Abhidharma, of the Buddhist psychological teachings, his name means, well, the son of Sari. And Sari, apparently, is possibly the name of an Indian minor bird. So there's a reference to that in the poem. So this is what Vangisa says in praise of Sariputta. Wise Sariputta is teaching the Dharma, so profound, so apposite, distinguishing the right path from the wrong path. He teaches in brief, or he teaches in enormous detail. His speech is as sweet as the song of the minor bird, and he's just as ready with his words. Hearing that sweet voice as he teaches, that lovely sound, so delightful, we listeners attend closely with happy minds, full of joy. So that's his poem about Sariputta. And this one is about the Buddha. And he says, 1,000 and more have gathered here to listen to the happily attained, the Buddha, as he teaches the faultless Dharma of Nirvana, which is proof against fear. We hear immaculate Dharma being taught by the fully enlightened one, shining, resplendent under the reverence of his followers. Oh, you are a Naga, the seventh Buddha of our age, and like a monsoon cloud, you rain down the Dharma. I, Vangisa, left my meditation hut with an earnest wish to see you, teacher. Great hero, I touch your feet. And in another poem, he starts off a bit autobiographical again. And in fact, one of the things he does talk about is his own conceit as a poet. He says, I thought of myself as a fabulous poet, and I realised I had to deal with that conceit. And he talks about how he would practice with conceit and how he would practice with his rather over self-regard. And he mentions that in this particular poem. He says, I used to travel from village to village, from city to city, drunk with my brilliance as a poet. Then I saw the Buddha, who had reached the further shore, the sage who crossed to the far shore of pain, taught me the Dharma. I heard the Dharma, I believed it, and confidence blossomed. Hearing the Buddha teach, I went forth. Oh, truly, Buddhas arise for the welfare of so many men and women who practice their teaching. The Buddha's enlightenment was for the benefit of those disciples who came to see reality. The sun-like Buddha, out of compassion, taught the four truths, taught the Eightfold Way. I have seen these truths just as they are. I have reached the goal. I have completed the Buddha's teaching. From the feast that he shared out, I got the best portion. So that's his enlightenment poem. And there are quite a few of them in here. A poem, and this continues in Zen tradition, where a poem represents what the enlightenment experience is like. And this is the way he describes it, as partly just sort of praising the Buddha's teaching and recalling his own pride as a poet, which was eclipsed by this. So that's a little bit about Vanghisa, the namesake of our founder here at West London. The first, perhaps the first great Buddhist poet writing or composing poetry in the Buddha's lifetime. And on the email going out this week, I'll give you a link. There's a whole book, actually, that brings all his poems together with an introduction and an explanation of them and so on. So I'll give you a link to that. You can actually find it online if you want to read some more of his poems. So look out for that. If you're not on on our list, and the mailing list for the core Sangha, for the Sangha night, then just write your name down near the door and write down you want the Sangha night email. So I'm going to finish in just a second. I just thought I'd sum up a little bit about going back to those four speech precepts. And in Triratna, in this particular Buddhist movement, Sangharakshita, our founder, has taught these precepts as a path. In other words, he's suggested that in a way you could see them as being progressive, as building on each other, from truthful to loving to helpful to harmonious speech. So when you're speaking, first of all, be truthful. And this is the Buddha's suggestion to Rahula, that that is the sine qua non. You really need to start with that integrity. You need to know at least what's going on. You need to understand yourself to some extent, and then to try to represent that without an attempt to mislead. Untruthful speech is to do with wanting to mislead people for your own benefit. That's why one's doing it. It's not just making a mistake. A mistake is a mistake. It's deliberately wanting to mislead others. And then, once you've at least got to that level of being truthful, you can then add on top of that. You can speak with a loving awareness of the other person. Truthfulness can happen in a vacuum. You can just write it and put it in a bottle and throw it over the side of the ship. But loving awareness needs the other person to be there. So the second of the speech precepts is to do with making a connection and actually being aware of the other person, taking them in as another human being. But then, if you can do that, you can move to the next level. And the next level is not just to be truthful, not just to be loving in your connection and awareness with the other, but actually to say something that's worth saying. So you might have the first two, and you're just, it's very nice, you're being very kind, oh, that's a nice shirt you've got, and so on, yeah, that's fine, there's nothing wrong with that. But then it may be you start to think, is there anything helpful I can say? Is there anything meaningful I can say? Is there anything useful I can say? And then if you can achieve that, if you can say something, which is quite an ask, actually, you can't always have anything useful to say to another person. We can't always, at least we can be truthful and loving, but we can't always say anything helpful. And it's very difficult, isn't it, if they come to you and they're going through a big issue or a problem in their life. The temptation is to think, oh, yeah, I'll sort that out. I'll find the answer, you know. And then you think, actually, I don't really know the answer. It's really difficult to know what is helpful for other people. And in a way, I think it's best to assume that you don't know. It's best to assume that we do not know what is best. And maybe to bring out the helpful speech more in dialogue, just to say, okay, how are you finding it? You know, what's going on? What's your view on it? You know, just listen. Learn to listen. And that can be the most helpful speech of all. If you can achieve helpful speech, if you can achieve meaningful speech, then there's a chance of complete harmony. The highest level of speech, harmonious speech. And this can become a mutual self-transcendence, where you don't feel any boundary, any barrier between yourself and the other. And you're communicating, but you don't need perhaps any words, or hardly any words. And this is perfect speech on the Eightfold Path, culminating in the silence of total harmony. You know, harmony at first may need words, you may need to sort things out. You may need to find a way of tuning in to the other person so you're really on the same wavelength as them, which happens very rarely, it seems to me, but it's wonderfully precious when it does happen. And when that has happened, it may be you can just shut up and you can just be with each other in silence. And that's sort of a good sign, isn't it? If you're with a friend and you realise we don't need to say anything to each other. We can just share this experience, whatever it is. We can just go for a walk up the hill and I don't even have to say, oh, that's a nice tree, isn't it? I know they've seen it as well, you know. Don't need to say that. We're sharing this experience. Perfect speech. Perfect speech is the third limb on the Noble Eightfold Path, a very important part of Buddhist practice. Okay, so I'm going to stop there. I hope that was of some interest. I find it really interesting sometimes just to hear about these early Buddhists. So you've heard about Rahula, the Buddha's son, the little seven-year-old boy, and the Buddha stressing the importance of truthfulness, and then giving him these images of pouring the water, and the image of the mirror. Reflect. Before you speak, reflect. While you speak, reflect. After you speak, reflect. And then Vangisa, the poet, and the value of poetry, the value of finding images and metaphors to use in your communication, even just to understand yourself better, to understand your own life better.